Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
All right, so I'm here with Brandon Hackett, who was on our Saturday Night Live panel at Sketchfest.
Hi.
So, how was the rest of your Sketchfest after that?
It was a lot of fun. I think I had another show with my friend Jonathan Langdon. We had Hackett and Langdon, the second of our two shows, and that one went, I think, pretty well. We reworked some stuff from the first performance. I had another show maybe that night too, just a couple of other sort of like miscellaneous like Sketchfest shows that were a lot of fun to do. I did Sholo, which was run by Christian Smith.
Cool.
Which is a lot of fun. Yeah.
Excellent. So getting to the heart of your love of comedy, what first interested you in doing comedy?
Let me see. So I guess, I don't know. It's weird to think about it because I think I feel like I kind of just slipped into comedy kind of out of nowhere. I was always, I went to a performing arts high school. Mm-hmm. So, the arts and I was in the drama program and the arts and performing and that sort of thing were always just kind of a part of my life, as a classic creative kid. And, I also think part of my like outside of school life was obviously watching a lot of TV, and I obviously loved shows like as a kid of the 90s, The Simpsons, and you know SNL, Mad TV, I absolutely loved at the time, and just any sort of I think I skewed definitely more towards comedy in terms of my television tastes. I think naturally what sort of happened was when I got to university. Actually, no, maybe it starts just before university. So my grade 12, my final year of high school, we actually had some people from Toronto Comedy come in because, Gary Rideout and Pat Thornton and Tal Zimmerman all came to my high school to help direct the grade 12s in like a sketch comedy unit just for fun because Gary was an alumnus of my high school.
Mm-hmm.
So they were still, he's still in touch with our drama teacher. And so we did, they helped produce and directed our sketch show at grade 12. And then I just started doing comedy, a sketch comedy in university during a review called The Bob, an annual review. Excuse me. And then because I had learned of the Sketchersons in grade 12 year in high school, because that was around the time they'd started the Sketchersons, I had sort of like kept abreast of what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember seeing audition notices for them back in probably 2006. And I auditioned in 2008, like a few rounds later. Mm-hmm. Didn't get in, but then they put me in like a farm teamy type sketch troupe, because that's around the time Comedy Bar was opening and they needed new programming. And then, so I performed with them and then just performed, kept performing, whatever. So anyway, that was a long-winded way of saying I kind of fell into comedy. Performance and writing was always something that I kind of did, but I didn't really think that there was never like an aha moment where I sort of saw someone performing or whatever and was like, oh, this is it. I didn't think comedy was even a thing.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that like theater is something, comedy just to me seems so intangible.
Yeah. I mean, like growing up, like I'm a little bit older. So I was more like an 80s, late 80s kid. So the brick wall comedy on every night, on every channel kind of thing. And then I just died. Mm-hmm. In the like in the 90s, like in the early 90s, that all went away. Mm-hmm. So I can like understand. It's like, so it's like, oh yeah, like Seinfeld's show is over. You know, you don't have this constant barrage of you know, comedy lifestyle shows kind of thing. So I can understand that would be like,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's not as present. It's there, but mm-hmm. in a different way. Like the Simpsons. Like the Simpsons were everywhere in the 90s.
Yeah,
yeah, like
absolutely.
That's. Yeah.
Well, and I guess I wonder if that affected a lot of the type of comedy that people tended to get into generationally, because I never had any interest in stand-up comedy growing up as an art form. And my wheelhouse right now is still sketch comedy and improv. Mm-hmm. Like I still want to write for television and that sort mm-hmm. of thing. But I feel like if I had come of age, or if I had been born a little bit earlier, you know, and was at least somewhat cognizant of the comedy boom, stand-up comedy boom, that would have shaped my perception of comedy and what I could strive for.
The 90s were very much a sketch.
Yes.
The era of sketch. You had like Mad TV, you had, you know, Mr. Show, Kids in the Hall, came at their peak kind of thing. So yeah, I mean that's I didn't really thought of it that way, and that it's just like, because it's like the echo from the vacuum left or the filling in of the vacuum left by stand up sort of collapsing in on itself when like, you know, all those clubs closed and all those shows went off the air.
Right.
So there's a lot of talent during that era. I mean, like I watched Mad TV because I watched everything I could get my hands on, but I it didn't click. But then years later, I'm like, almost all of the people from that cast and all of the writers on that show are people whose work I love now.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, what? That I did not realize that, Patton Oswalt writing for that show, all these really great performers and really great writers.
Yeah. Well, it's even like, I think most prominently, Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key.
Yeah.
Those are two huge, those are people that I didn't expect at all. No offense to them, but they were kind of like later in my watching of Mad TV. Like when I think of like classic Mad TV for me, you know, it's the cast with like Phil LaMarr, Nicole Sullivan, Deborah Wilson, Pat Kilbane, Will Sasso, like just Alex Borstein, like that sort of like concretized ensemble. And then, you know, when Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key started to come in, it was sort of like when I had started to pivot a little bit more towards SNL.
Yeah, I think I'd sort of walked away from the show by that point. I started on SNL, like that's where I got into sketch as a something I loved, that and SCTV as a kid. So I mean, I came to Mad TV and I was just like, it just never sat right with me,
because
I think my tastes were set beforehand.
Yeah, I feel like I'm sure this is not, you don't want this whole thing to be us talking about like our sketch influences, but I feel like I started out liking Mad TV. SNL was like a bit of a later thing for me. Mm-hmm. I always knew that it was there, but I think there was something about the structuredness of the show at the time that maybe I was a bit bored by, or I didn't find it necessarily funny as a kid. Like I think as a really young kid, I was more into, because I kind of get this too from watching In Living Color back in the day, was, you know, like big characters, humor that's kind of a little bit super upfront about things like race and that sort of thing, to the point where sometimes it can be kind of rude or whatever. I think I really responded to that really, really strongly, which is why a lot of my really early sketch comedy is very big and character-y. And now I kind of, to be perfectly honest, I kind of hate character comedy sometimes. I'm way more of a like SNL, like structured, like I love a sort of architecture of a nice, you know, nicely written, nicely thought through sketch. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's very interesting.
Cool.
I feel like once in a while I like talk to someone about or sketch comedy or whatever, and then I kind of sheepishly bring up Mad TV because I know it could go either way as a reference, and then often that person will be like, Mad TV was great, it was better than SNL, you know, like during that narrow window in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, SNL got really stale coming out of the 80s and into the 90s, so I mean, that's why you had like two very ultra different sets of sketch sort of answering that. I mean, you had Mad TV, which is completely, totally over the top,
right?
Huge. And then you had like Mr. Show and Kids in the Hall, which are very refined, but in this way where it's like it's sort of like, no, we're not with you guys. We're doing our thing over here. And it's weird and freaky and kind of crazy, which is interesting because, you know, some of, you know, the kids guys, you know, worked on SNL for a time kind of thing. So it's like there's a period when I think a lot of people are like, yeah, SNL's just not cutting it anymore. We need something new. And then they upped their game and they're like, you know, came back with like Will Ferrell and that the killer cast in the mid 90s that really I think brought a lot of people back to the show.
Yeah. Well, what's your sort of favorite era of SNL? Like, what's your...
I rewatched a lot of it, and it kind of killed a lot of the love of, like, the nostalgia that I had. Like,
really?
You know, it used to be like, oh, Mike Myers era, and, you know, like, because they're so great, and Mike Myers I first saw on City Limits, you know, and he first introduced Wayne Campbell as like the kid from Scarborough kind of thing. And so I mean, like, I that's a character I was familiar with, and that era is like, oh, these are, you know, people who are, you know, they I understand and I get, and, you know, and you know, Bill Hartman and like all these amazing talents. But then I go back and I'm like, it's just as hit and miss then as it ever was now or in any period. So, I mean, like, I love Saturday Night Live because when it's good, it's amazing. There's no, like, a good episode is better than a great episode of a lot of other shows. But there's a lot of bad episodes to the point where it's like, it's usually a one good sketch, bad sketch, good sketch, bad sketch. There's no consistency, but yeah, I mean, they're doing freaking incredibly hard work. You know, it's not easy and you know, what they're doing. So yeah, I don't really have a favorite era. I mean, mainly because I'm like, I've had to sort of like divorce myself of that illusion of, oh, this was the best. And like, no, there are some pretty big stinkers.
Yes. Well, it's like, it's also very much a show where like one or two sketches every show or something like that is something that stand out, I think.
Yeah. Like the last two episodes though, Sandra Oh and Kit
Harrington. Yeah.
Those were consistently good front to back, I found. Like, and that to the, where it's like, that is unusual. Mm-hmm. Like these are possibly the best episodes of the entire season, if not the last few years, because it was like it kept its pace up. It never got sort of too, like, none of the sketches really got sort of too up their own ass about like what they're trying to do there. They didn't drag out the intro, like the political intro, too long, which is like my wife will watch it and she'll call me when they're done with like the 10 minutes of Donald Trump impersonations, because it's like, it's like, you know, okay, it was funny the first time and the first 10 times, this 100th time is kind of beating a dead horse.
It kind of feels a little bit like, what is the best thing to even compare it to? But it just feels like, you know, it's just feels like pantomime a little bit after a point.
Yeah. I mean, they're not adding anything new to their critique there. No. Like, you know, and when, yeah, so with the intro this week where it was former vice president
Joe Biden,
yeah, the Joe Biden like sensitivity training, and I was like, this is because they're going for a target that's not a target that they would normally go for, and it's valid criticism of how he just doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, and it's just like, oh, this is actually funny. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not like, okay, Alec Baldwin is going to do his middling impersonation and just purse his lips for ages. So,
right. Yeah.
I mean, it's just been, I don't know what changed over those last two episodes, and maybe next week it'll be back to normal, but you know, it's just when it's good, it just blows your mind.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Yeah. And looking at Mad TV though, I mean, like, you know, Key and Peele, like beyond their sketch show, mm-hmm. two really prolific, you know, actors and writers in their own right, that like watching Mad TV, like they were good, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't have imagined them, you know, doing all of the stuff they're doing now, just because that show was kind of like, oh yeah, it's just, it's that show that's trying to do what SNL did, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Like this Twilight Zone. Have you watched any of the Twilight Zone stuff yet?
I have not watched the Twilight Zone yet. No.
Oh, the first episode, Comedian, you have to watch.
Okay.
Because Kumail Nanjiani, it's got a lot of call out. Like the second one was okay. It's a remake of, it's yet another interpretation of Kara at 20,000 feet. Right. 30,000 feet.
And so this will be the third or fourth
third iteration, because there's the Shatner, then there's the Lithgow movie, and which is just a straight movie. Remake of the original.
It's this a pretty decent version of it though.
Yeah, it twists it. So it's different.
Though in the movie, the pall of Vic Morrow's death hangs over the movie. That makes it a bit awful to watch.
No, but it's but the Comedian one, the first one, is like,
yeah,
that is so clearly written by a comedian, mm-hmm. and all of the people in it are comedians themselves. Like, they're this full, like, you know, Kumail in that title role, in the main role of the story, and it's set in a comedy club, and I'm like, every person I know who does comedy, I'm sure, has had like a nightmare similar to what's going on in this, or that a dream of that. So it's really an interesting twist, and there's some really interesting subtle callbacks to, you know, classic, mm-hmm. Classic Twilight Zone. So yeah, that's a must watch. I really highly recommend that one. So I'm curious where it's going to go from there, but.
Well, absolutely watch it. I mean, I loved Us. I was really, I thought, have you seen Us?
Not yet, no.
Okay.
It's on my list, but I gotta see it when it's in the, you know.
You gotta see Us. It, mostly I was relieved because I just wanted Jordan. I loved Get Out so much.
Yeah.
It is probably one of my favorite movies ever. And I just wanted his follow-up movie. I think initially I was just very skeptical at the idea that he was going to keep making these sort of social horror movies.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't want him to get stuck in a rut or to be kind of pigeonholed into one kind of thing or whatever. And Us is just great. It's sort of a broadening of that, of his sort of like style now.
But he does such, I mean, I haven't seen Us, but like his other work is such a perfect balance, mm-hmm. of, because I'm not a big horror fan. So like it takes a lot for me to go and see horror movies. Mm-hmm. But when I've watched his work, it's like, oh, this, it's not gratuitous in how it applies horror. Like it's not Hitchcockian. Mm-hmm. It's Hitchcock has this slow burn that is uniquely, it's his own unique take on scary. Mm-hmm. And it resonates with me in a way that I'm like I want to watch this, like, whereas like, you know, Saw or whatever scary movie that's coming out, I'm like, yeah, I don't care. But this is like, oh, this is applying nuance to these ideas, and it's there's a little bit of humor in some points to like just release the tension, mm-hmm. and then it builds back up. So he just applies all these tools that a lot of, especially like the sort of slasher splatter horror movies don't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, there was a loss to the art form, mm-hmm. of being scary that he's bringing back.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And like the Twilight Zone ones are really interesting too, because it's very paced differently than his other work, and most of it's paced like an old Twilight Zone movie show, which is they're all super slow burn. Like, so they'll set up a premise, and then, you know, it isn't until the third act where it really starts to sink in as to like, oh, this is what's going on here. This is the badness kind of thing. So, yeah. We've done a lot of talking about sketch and stuff. Do you have a favorite album or special that you've ever liked?
Favorite album or special? I mean, probably one of my favorite albums is Paul F. Tompkins, Laboring Under Delusions. That's something I've been re-listening to lately. Do you just want one or just like a list?
Oh, whatever. Yeah. Like, what are ones that you sure. really love?
So I love that one. That one's a lot of fun, where he sort of talks about all of the jobs that he's had, including comedy, that sort of lead up to where he sort of is at that particular stage in his career. I think one of the first comedy albums I ever listened to was Steve Martin's Wild and Crazy Guy, which I think that's such an obvious answer in a lot of ways.
I think it's one of those albums that everybody listens to early on at some point.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. It's such a huge album.
It's huge. Yeah. Well, it's sort of like I grew up not really like I knew Steve Martin, but I didn't know he was this sort of like this. I didn't know what his sort of like main claim to fame was. I just knew him as like, okay, there's the dad from Father of the Bride, or, you know, like blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, seeing him in movies. I mean, like, I guess he's funny, you know, and whatever. And you'd see these sort of stand-up retrospectives on like TV, and they'd be like, you know, Steve Martin's a genius. You'd be like, really? Like, the archive footage you showed is just him with an arrow through. Like, I just don't understand.
Yeah.
And then I listened to that album and was like, oh, okay, I get it. He's like a crazy spaceman. Yeah. So smart and so funny.
Are you going to be seeing him on Friday?
Wait, what? He's in town on Friday?
Him and Martin Short, bring it to their show. Like, I didn't realize until it was way too late. And I thought, oh, damn, I'm not going to get tickets. Then my wife got them for me for Christmas. And like, I'm like, I'm going to get to see them.
That's incredible.
I'm so happy.
I mean, seeing as you got those tickets at Christmas time, I bet there's no tickets left. I also have a show on Friday, but I guess I can't. But yeah, I feel like I would find the show. But I feel like I would love the show, and then I would be... Yeah, you know, I'd love the show. What am I saying? I would absolutely love the whole show because they're both great.
Yeah.
Enjoy that show. I didn't even know.
I'm looking at it. Jason saw them in London when they were doing... It's just a continuation of the same tour. And it's like one of those things like Martin Short, I think, you know, he's never going to stop performing. He's going to like... The day he dies will be the day of his last performance.
Yes.
But, you know, Steve Martin has taken so much time away from... comedic performance. I'm like, I'm glad to see him this time because I'm like, right. I don't know when I'll be able to see him live again, kind of thing.
I kind of like that element of Steve Martin, though. I really love that, like, you don't get oversaturated with him.
Yeah. It's a precious commodity, his comedy.
Yes.
It's like, it's not like, oh, well, he'll just do another thing in a month kind of thing.
Yeah. Because it's also like, that's sort of been the entire, that's been his career in a way, you know, like when, like he quit stand up right at the height of his career, you know, he was so big and then he was just like, ah.
I think he only does it when he feels he has something interesting to say.
Which I love. I absolutely love that. I mean, I think, I love that he tries his hand out of other things that he really likes, you know, like playwriting and that sort of thing. I'm not always a fan of people who excel in one arena and then feel the need to dabble in another one. Because oftentimes the results are kind of mixed. But because they've already reached such prominence, they're able to kind of get their stuff out there in a way that like other people in the other arena. I'm being kind of vague, but I don't know. I also just like that element of Steve Martin. Like, he just seems like a person who's really interested in art and just needs to take, you know, time away to kind of not oversaturate the world with him or whatever.
Yeah. Now, you are a member of Second City.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, when did you join Second City?
Like the main stage cast or just in general?
Why don't you start in general and then make it to the main stage?
Sure. Okay. So I got my sort of first gig with Second City. I started out in like EDCO. So I got my first gig back in late 2012, like a month or something after mm-hmm. I finished their conservatory program. I was just hired to do like an EDCO gig. And then I was performing sort of on and off as an understudy with the official like EDCO. EDCO's the educational company and they perform mm-hmm. shows for schools and that sort of thing. On and off for 2 or 3 years. And then in 2015 I was hired to the touring company, which is in Toronto, Toronto Second City. Touring company doubles as the understudy cast and they perform a show on Monday nights, while the main stage cast has the night off. So I was on tour co for a full year, and then 2016 I was promoted to the main stage, and I was on the main stage for just over 2 years. So I finished on the main stage this past August 29th, I think it was. Yeah.
So what drew you to improv?
So I used to do improv in high school, and it was, I was a big fan of it just as sort of, I think I came to it initially as like a thing that drama teachers would do to get, you know, students kind of loose. Like I really loved that. And I used to watch Whose Line, like the original YTV used to have, like 8 o'clock PM every night, the British Who's Line, which is what I started watching. So I was really into sort of like that theater sportsy style of improv when I was really young. So when I started to do sketch comedy, I think I started to feel like I was kind of in a bit of a rut, and I knew that Second City was in town. I'd never seen a Second City show. I only kind of knew what they were because I used to watch SCTV. When I'd started to kind of poke my head around the Toronto comedy scene, I realized that a lot of people were like doing improv, and people were saying, well, improv is a great way to kind of like help with sketch comedy. And I didn't fully know how or why. Like I didn't have like a full grasp on how that could help structural comedy writing. So I took classes at Second City just because a lot of people had been doing that. And thought it'd be a nice way to kind of work a different part of my brain. And then thankfully I was getting it. My sketch writing experience and some of my previous improv experience helped me kind of hit the ground running a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I just started to get kind of work and recognition from Second City. So then I kind of kept at it. And that's sort of what drew me to improv.
My level C is next week's last week of my level C course. So I'm like doing the program myself, and it's like, I'm just like, I didn't enjoy improv in high school. I don't know. It's just the kids that I was with back then, you know, doing drama and stuff. It's just, it didn't click, but like coming at it now, I'm like, it's almost like meditative in a way. Like I go into those classes, I'm like, you know, the stress of the week. And then I walk out and I'm like, oh, I feel good. Like just being in that moment and doing it, it's so fun. I don't know.
What do you think the difference is from being like doing improv in high school versus improv now for you?
I think it was just the people want to be there. Like in high school, it's like these are kids who are like, I'm taking this drama class because it's an easy class, which is, you know, it's not, but that's the mentality of a kid in high school. I think there's that there, and just there's a commitment to the other people in the class at the training center that wasn't in high school, because it's like everybody's people were trying to one-up one another in high school. Everybody's like, I want to win, and that's not what it's about. It's like there's the offer is more understood now with a bunch. And I mean, I'm probably one of the oldest people in my class, you know? So it's like, these are a lot of these people that I'm in the class with are way funnier than me. They're way more awesome than I am. And they're younger and they're hungry and happy and interesting. And it's like, just the energy is so powerful when you go into those classes. It's just like, Yeah, I was doing it on a different day of the week, and it's just like on Sunday with very low energy, and that there wasn't enough people in that class, so I got moved to Tuesday, and I'm like, I'm never moving from Tuesday. It's like just everyone's like, oh yeah,
yeah, that like after work energy, like blowing off steam kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, and it's such a this wide array of different experiences and stuff too, which is like, you know, in high school you're all like, you know, high school kids, you know, this is like you've got people who, you know, work in the financial sector, and then you've got people who work in, you know, charities and construction, and like there's one fella in my class who he gives 110% every time. It kind of reminds me of like a John Candy kind of like loving energy in every scene that he's in. But he also, like, used to work in the film industry, so he was like, he's like, oh yeah, so that time that, you know, Bill Murray and I were just driving around, I'm like, what? And he's like, oh yeah, I forgot to, he pulls out this picture of him and Bill Murray driving around, and right. I'm like, he kind of buried the lead there.
Right, yeah.
And it's not, and it's like, it's not bragging, it's more like, oh, this is... Yeah, you know, this is experience. So it's like this wide array of experiences, and that's one of the things I love about improv is everybody brings something different to the table, and it's like you're sharing. It's like a smorgasbord or a buffet of ideas that everybody's sort of sharing and giving to one another.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I think that hits the nail on the head quite a bit. Is that now, like when you do improv as an adult, everyone wants to be there, and it's a lot more supportive, and there's less of that sort of like baggage of like trying to look cool,
yeah,
or, you know, dealing with your own like teenage bullshit or whatever. Sorry, I don't know if I'm not to swear.
It's all good.
And and it is definitely like I started taking classes when I was like working full time as like a pension specialist or whatever. And I was like, number one, a job I was not suited for, but, yeah, doing those classes on like a weeknight, it was like a great way to blow off steam and that sort of thing. And it was just like great. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned earlier the Sketchersons, you've been involved with them since 2008.
2013, but the first time I auditioned for them was 2008. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's the process of writing for the sketches, like writing for Sunday Night Live or something like that?
Okay, so basically the process for writing for Sunday Night Live is literally, so we're putting up a show every single week, Saturday Night Live style show every week, and we basically just write on our own over the course of the week, and we come to a pitch meeting every Thursday, and we pitch usually at least two sketches each. We cast them and we have a read through, and then our head writer usually collects all the scripts. She'll sort of like communicate with the host, because there's usually a host every week. Get a sort of an idea for what the host wants to do, and then just before Sunday, she'll have a running order ready of which sketches are in the show, and the casting, finalized casting, and that sort of thing. And then you just rehearse all day Sunday, or for a few hours on Sunday, and then put on the show at like 9:30 or something like that. I think it's been a few years since I've been in the troupe, but I'm pretty sure that's how it still functions.
Now, how would that compare to, you know, being in Second City in one of their shows?
It's probably a lot more rigorous, I would have to say. I mean, outside of the 10 weeks where we're writing the show at Second City, for the rest of the run, you're kind of just there every night. Like, it's a different type of rigor, but it's like you're just, you show up to work and you perform the same show every night. If there are improvised elements, that's new. And then obviously there's an improv set at the end of the show, and that's entirely new, but there's no real prep that goes into any of that. You just, you basically, that's the whole job. With Sunday Night Live, it's writing at least two new sketches a week and hoping that they're good, or making sure that they're good, or learning the skill set in order to make them serviceable or good or whatever. And then learning an entirely new show on like in a day, basically, doing it again at infinitum. So they're both different types of skill sets, I think with Second City, I obviously learned it did ultimately strengthen my writing, but I also feel there was also definitely a feeling that I wasn't writing for 2 years, you know, like even though now that I'm back to writing a bit more regularly now, and I feel like I have a more concretized process or skill set for writing or vision, I suppose, that comes from working there and writing for reviews. At least with the Sketchersons, it was so rigorous and it was so we would just be doing a show all the time. So I was just basically better at putting forward ideas, making them serviceable, putting them out, whatever, and then making them better on Sunday, and then kind of getting better that way.
Is there ever a sketch that you really wanted to get up mounted that you just never were able to get past that finish line?
For Sunday Night Live?
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm sure there were like dozens of sketches, because I have dozens of sketches that obviously didn't make the show, because I, you know, wouldn't get two things in the show all the time. I guess I had one sketch. I'm going to describe the premise, and it's not going to sound funny at all, because it's not. But to me, I thought it was kind of clever at the time. But the idea that these two parents are waiting for this kid to come home. And the kid comes home, and they're just like so pissed off, and it's like, where were you? And he's like, I was just hanging out or whatever. And they keep grilling him, and eventually they're like, you were in the Matrix, weren't you? And the kid's like, no. And the whole thing is just sort of, yeah, see, it's not a funny sketch, but the idea that like the kid just plugs into the Matrix all the time, and it's just a bunch of references to the Matrix, I really liked, but that never made it into the show, understand it justifiably. What else? I don't know. I mean, I had some sketches that made it into the show that I'd pitch a bunch of times, and then because I'd be like, oh, this is funny, this is great, and then you'd sort of see them in front of an audience, and the audience would kind of not like it, and then you'd be like, okay, I get why this didn't make it. I guess a sketch I wrote one that was about a production of The Phantom of the Opera, where the Phantom's foot gets caught in like a trap door, and then that whole sketch is them just trying to still perform the show while his foot while he's like stuck in the trap door, and like more people are pushed on stage, and they're all just trying to like using improv language, and then like the Phantom understudy comes on, so it's sort of like there are two Phantoms on stage. I like that sketch a lot. I don't think it was ever like a hit, like a huge hit, but again, I don't know.
Now, as you mentioned, they have hosts on every episode. Was there a host that you really enjoyed performing with in particular, or a story of a host that you really stands out?
Well, there are a lot of really fun, cool hosts. We've had a lot of like bigger names as hosts sometimes. Yeah. Like one of my favorite shows was probably the one with Scott Adsit and John Lutz. Mm-hmm. That was really great because I got both of my sketches in the show, and they were both host sketches. Yeah. So I got to perform like a solid one-on-one time with Scott Adsit, who's one of my Second City heroes, and Lutz, who's like a really great comedy writer that I really like.
He's been involved in so many.
Yep.
Awesome things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think he still writes for The Tonight Show. No, not Tonight Show.
He writes for Seth.
Seth. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Even better.
Yeah. And every once in a while, it's like, oh, yeah, this is all Lutz.
Yeah. So I love that. I got to work with Scott Thompson, which was really, really cool. I mean, Kids in the Hall are like huge and such a looming. Kids in the Hall are such an important, number one, they're extremely funny, one of the funniest troops ever, but such an extremely important force for me, for normalizing, I think, my perception of like queerness within not only just comedy but in the world. Mm-hmm. Because Scott is a sort of queer member of the group, he is the queer member of the group, and in sort of a similar way that, you know, Freddie Mercury kind of queered the group Queen, he queered the sketch group Kids in the Hall. So for a long time, I just thought the entire sketch group, everyone was gay, because all of these sketches about, you know, like
steps and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was so like as a kid watching that within this sort of world where queerness had not been normalized or was still a little bit weird or off or whatever, that to me seemed so, that was such an important thing to view and shape kind of like my own perception of queer, my burgeoning queer identity, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And anyway, getting to work with him was really, really cool because I wrote a sketch for both of us to perform where we were these NPR sort of broadcasters, performing the show called the Sassy Gay Chat Show, but we were just so sedate, like Terry Gross or something like that. And he helped me do heavy rewrites on the sketch because I was quite green still at the time. But it was great. And then we just talked a bunch after the show. So that was a really great experience. That was sort of a interesting sort of full circle kind of moment, I think.
Kids in the Hall are one of the few comedy troupes where almost their entire body of work holds up decades later.
Yep.
Like you go back and you watch Monty Python or SCTV is pretty strong too, because I think they kept it broad enough that it wasn't nailed down to like a premise that was stupid. Kids in the Hall, like it's timely today, like watching any of their material. Like there's there's occasionally a character where it's like, ooh, but I just, they, as all of them as performers are just astounding.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So Kevin McDonald, when he was at the Rivoli last time, and it's just because he has this podcast where it's basically him telling a story about his time in the Kids in the Hall. 9 out of 10 times it's him telling a story about when he lived with Scott. And it's just like, it was just a joy to watch. Just because like they all of them have this like this natural, this natural charisma and talent. And Bruce opened for him, and they're terrific.
So yeah.
I can only imagine how much fun it would have been to work with Scott.
Absolutely. I mean, from what I understand, they also fought quite a bit.
They'll be the first people to admit that.
Yes. Yeah.
So Ken McDonald's podcast, if you've never listened to it, I really recommend it, because it's like there's so much of the process that he talks about and how they're dynamic as a troupe, and it's just kind of cool to hear from behind the scenes kind of thing.
Check it out.
I was watching another interview you did. You saw Oh Hello Live on Broadway. Kroll and Delaney Mulaney doing their like peak characters. So how was that?
That was a lot of fun. Yeah. I was just on vacation during my first review. So I went to New York and I went to see it, and it was one of the best nights I'd ever had. Like such a fun, ambitious show with truly the two stupidest characters you could ever imagine to have a Broadway stage. It was great. The guest that night was F. Murray Abraham.
Oh, boy.
Which was unbelievable. Have you seen the show?
I've seen the special. I didn't see it live. I wanted to see it live, and I just couldn't work it out at the time.
Right, yeah.
Every night was a different guest. Like,
it's a different guest, yeah.
They had, Patrick Stewart on at one point.
And
Ian McKellen as well.
Yeah, I guess it's whoever was around you.
Yeah, he's oh, okay, I'll be on it. John Hamm, I love it.
Yeah.
The special is kind of a love letter to a very particular New York Broadway sort of mentality, but a love letter in a very, acidic, biting kind of way, which is hilarious. It's like, I'm just like, it takes some guts to mount something like that.
It does. Well, and it's very much like John Mulaney's wheelhouse of he is kind of like an old New York, that's not the right word, but like fetishist.
Yeah.
A little bit, like even down to his accent a little bit, he's Chicagoan, but he does lean very heavily in a kind of New York style.
Well, I think fetish is the perfect way to describe it, because it's like, and in even the more classical sense of like a almost like a sort of a worshipful kind of way, you know, not just a sexy kind of way, but yeah, like everything about him screams old New York.
Yes.
You know, like the way he dresses, the way he talks, the way, like all of his mannerisms is just, and, but it works. It's genuine. It's not like it's that. That's one of the reasons why I love him as a performer is like, there's no artifice there. It looks like it, but that's just who he is. Like a couple years ago, I went to a one-on-one with him and for JFL 42, they had an interview with him before his show, his headliner show. And is he just like that? He's just very giving as a performer, like just to the other person on the stage with him, but always on. And it's like, it's just this like lightning fast wit about him. And it's just like, and to see him with Nick Kroll too, like just the two of them together. Amazing.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Well, because they're like best friends.
Yeah.
You know, they perform so well together because they are just genuinely best friends. Yeah, just an extremely tight but loose, but loosely tight and tightly loose dynamic. It's so, it was just so good. It was like every single line was some really hot joke, you know, hot, stupid joke. And yeah, just the show being this assemblage of tropes.
So funny. How close is the one that you saw to the Netflix special?
Well, it's the exact same show. It's the
exact same show, just the
host changes, and I think what the only significant difference was, I think for the Netflix special, they added Matthew Broderick.
Yeah.
So they still had the joke of someone being behind the door. I think when I was there, they said Nathan Lane was going to be behind the door or something like that. But no one, to the best of my recollection, he didn't show up. Like no one was like behind the door.
Yeah.
They might have done that, I feel, a few times, but yeah, not on my night. But yeah, watching the special after the fact and seeing that they managed to get Matthew Broderick, just for like a quick gag.
Matthew Broderick seems like the kind of guy who's willing to make fun, like to just like go for a joke.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you've been on This Hour is 22 Minutes, The Beaverton, Baroness von Sketch. That's just a few of your credits. So how, and not to mention, Doug and his Devil? No.
Gary and his Demons. Yes.
Gary and his Demons. So how is like, you know, TV work and like TV sketch and TV writing, how is that different from working for the stage?
You mean specifically like just specifically with like writing or just like
writing and performing, like as a performer and as a writer? Sure. How do you feel it's different for you?
Well, certainly within performing, it's a lot smaller, which sounds kind of weirdly obvious, but it's still something that I'm kind of like getting my head around a little bit, because most of my experience has obviously been on the stage. So I'm so used to when I'm performing sketch comedy being very big and theatrical and like using all the projection that I learned in high school. But it is a lot smaller, a lot more refined a little bit performance wise. My experience TV writing, I mean, I'm still trying to drum up a lot more experience with TV writing. I did write for, I forget which season, but it was season 23 or 22 of 22 Minutes. And the writing for that show was quite, it was very rigorous because it was not just sketch comedy. It was copy jokes. It was sort of field pieces and that sort of thing. And I was also involved in my own field piece that made it to air, that also involved a little bit of improv. But the writing with 22 Minutes, I think specifically with sketch and how that stacks up to the other sketch that I've written, is there's so much less time. You're kind of writing, the sketches in 22 Minutes are about like a minute long each, you kind of aim for. So you want to kind of hit the, like get to the joke and then maybe hit it once or twice more or something like that. Like it's really, or you stack it up with, you get the premise and then you stack it up with as many jokes as you can. Like it's such a, it's quite a different beast. And I don't know that I fully mastered it in the time that I was there. But as opposed to, like, you know, if you're performing a sketch theatrically, you can kind of breathe a little bit depending on if you're right. You know, like with Second City, you have a lot of scenes, like scenic sketch comedy or, you know, or whatever. Yeah, so it sort of changes. And then, like, the other writers' rooms that I've been in, like, I was in a story room for show recently, and, you know, that was a bit more of a deliberate process than sketch comedy. Sketch comedy, I'm so used to it being kind of ephemeral or, like, quick. You just kind of get it out there and it's done and then move on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. And with this, we're kind of envisioning the story for a whole season and breaking apart each episode and trying to see the sort of, like, how each functions within a sort of grander narrative arc of a season. A lot more thinking, a lot more planning, way more collaborative than I'm kind of used to, if I'm being mm-hmm. perfectly honest. I like to write alone. My sort of compact answer would be it changes from project to project. Mm-hmm. Just depending on what the needs of each project are. I'd say TV writing is way more, definitely way more rigorous and way more just kind of like throw as many ideas as you can at the wall.
Now you've also done video game writing as well.
A little bit, yeah.
So how does that compare to, like, all these other, like, have you been able to draw from any of your sketch and your improv experience? And
A little bit, yeah. The main, like, video game writing is just, it's mostly, like, because I was writing for an app called Tap by Wattpad and wrote a couple of these sort of, like, choose your own adventure stories. Mm-hmm. And with those, there was a degree of, I guess with, like, writing these sort of, like, branching narratives, there's a degree of, I guess, just sort of, like, throwing ideas out there. Okay. I say there's a lot of, like, planning on knowing where your narrative is going. And I guess that's sort of true of any type of, like, narrative writing. But there's a degree of planning, and then there's sort of, like, playing within the sort of, like, structure, the established structure that you can kind of do. Mm-hmm. So once we sort of figured out the structure of each narrative, then I can sort of play around a little bit with, like, certain jokes, if there were jokes and stuff in there, but not all of them were, like, comedy games or anything like that. Yeah, but I don't know, everything is sort of, like, a different everything is its own kind of beast, so I feel like I'm kind of constantly learning every time I do a new sort of, like, writing job or whatever.
Now so you worked on a lot of different platforms, and with things like podcasts and YouTube, mm-hmm. Really almost like a lot of the podcasts that I've been listening to, it's almost like a rebirth of, like, radio plays and stuff like that. How do you feel these new platforms are changing comedy? Have you noticed anything with, like, how they're impacting the comedy world?
Well, I mean, I think this is a fairly common observation, but I think it just means that people can get work out there a lot more frequently and a lot more directly. Mm-hmm. So I feel like almost every one of my friends or colleagues has a comedy album, for example, released that's played on Sirius XM and, you know, released through iTunes or whatever. And 10 years ago, the idea to me that anyone I knew would have a comedy album seemed so far-fetched, because that seemed like something like, oh, you need to be approached by, like, I don't know how that works, but, like, approached by a record label or whatever. But it's sort of, people can just release things online. And I think that is a really good, I think it's great. I think it's amazing. I think it lends to a proliferation. I think just as with, like, the Sketchersons, you know, I would just get work done and then move on and get more work done and just sort of have this whole body of work eventually. Mm-hmm. I think that's what this sort of proliferation of platforms for people to release material onto is good for. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of, like, first common effect, I guess, I see. If there's a second sort of observation that I can make, I guess it's maybe that, like, I don't know. I think it's probably the only observation I really have to make. Yeah.
Now, are there any comedy acts that you would or shows that you'd recommend people mm-hmm. go and check out right now?
Yeah, I guess like in the city right now, definitely check out Yas Queen. That's a show that's run by Nilu Handa. And that's a really, really good show, primarily like women of color. That's a really, really, really fun, really funny show. That's from the city. I'll always recommend, obviously, the sketches in Sunday Night Live. Rap Battles is always a great time. Musical, Improv Karaoke, which is run by my friend Jordan Armstrong. That's I think it's the second Monday of every month at Comedy Bar. One of the, sort of secretly, one of the city's best shows, I think. Okay. Which is sort of, people just get like, just improvise karaoke. or improvise a song on the spot kind of deal. Mm-hmm. What else? There's so many great shows in the city. I feel like I don't get out to as many as I would like to, or as I used to. But those would be the key ones. Yeah.
And do you have anything that you would like people to know about that you're working on right now?
my taxes. I don't know. I mean, I guess my friend Jonathan Langdon and I, as the sketch duo Hackett and Langdon, I think we're trying to do a lot more things. So definitely... keep abreast. Keep doing Google searches. I don't know. For Hackett and Langdon. We have a show on April 24th at, I think, Bad Dog Theater at the Templeton Philharmonic called Templeton Manor. So we're doing 10-minute set then. And yeah, hopefully more things. I think we want to try to do an album this year.
Awesome.
Speaking of. So we'll see if that comes to fruition or not. But hopefully.
Terrific.
Yeah.
And if people wanted to follow you on social media, do you have...
Yeah. The best place is on Twitter. So at Brandon Hackett, BrandonHackett. So that's my Twitter handle. If you want, you can follow me on Instagram, but I rarely update it. And it's pretty much just my personal things. So don't worry about it. And I live around Bathurst and Bloor, if you want to just check me out there. I told that joke on the Comedy Album Live podcast. So there you go. That's a joke again.
No, callback. Callback.
It's a callback. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been Comedy Album Book Club. Thank you, Brandon, for joining us.
And, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Perfect.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.